U.S. engages in a so-called humanitarian intervention, first of all, generally is based on lies.
The U.S. to put sanctions on Ethiopian government. We want the U.N. to put sanctions on Ethiopian government.
Ethiopia has the right and duty to defend its territory and restore legal order.
Tigray is the birthplace of Ethiopian civilization. Nobody cares more about the people of Tigray than the rest of the Ethiopian people.
It's a PR stunt to try and label any kind of instability that takes place as a terrorist threat in order to provide access for AFRICOM.
From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Radio Network and its affiliate stations across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. So-called humanitarian intervention, also known as humanitarian war, is the flagship of the Biden administration's foreign policy and the subject of this episode of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We begin with one of our new Secretary of State, Antony Blinken's comedy routines at a recent press conference.
President Biden is committed to putting human rights back at the center of American foreign policy. And that's a commitment that I and the entire Department of State take very seriously. We will bring to bear all the tools of our diplomacy to defend human rights and hold accountable perpetrators of abuse. The report we're releasing today shows that the trend lines on human rights continue to move in the wrong direction. We see evidence that in every region of the world, this is happening.
When someone makes a move of which we don't approve, who is it that always intervenes? UN and OAS, they have their place, I guess. But first, send the Marines.
We see it in the genocide being committed against the predominantly Muslim Uyghurs and other ethnic and religious minority groups in Xinjiang. The attacks on and the imprisonment of opposition politicians, anti-corruption activists, independent journalists in places like Russia, Uganda, Venezuela. We see it in the arbitrary arrests, beatings, and other violence against protesters in Belarus.
We'll send them all we've got, John Wayne and Randolph Scott. Remember those exciting fighting scenes? To the shores of Tripoli, but not to Mississippi. What do? We send the Marines.
We also see it in the ways authoritarian governments are using and exporting new technologies to surveil and harass citizens and spread disinformation at home and abroad. We see it in what's happening in Burma.
For might makes right, until they've seen the light, they've got to be protected, all their rights respected, till somebody we like can be elected. Members of the Corps all hate the thought of war. They'd rather kill them off by peaceful means. Stop calling it aggression. Ooh, we hate that expression. We only want the world to know that we support the status quo. They love us everywhere we go. So when in doubt, send the Marines.
KPFK producer Polina Vasilyev spoke with University of Pittsburgh law professor Dan Kovalik about international law as codified in the UN Charter.
The U.S. over time has developed this idea that is sold successfully to the American people, particularly the liberals, that the U.S. needs to intervene around the world to protect human rights. And so that is the cause du jour that the U.S. claims it is fighting these wars for, whether it's going to Iraq to, you know, we first claimed to, at least in 2003, to destroy weapons of mass destruction that were not there.
We can't let the world's worst leaders blackmail, threaten, hold freedom-loving nations hostage with the world's worst weapons.
But then later, of course, Bush turned it into a war for democracy and freedom. Same thing with Afghanistan. Of course, Obama destroyed Libya very explicitly on human rights and humanitarian grounds. But time and again, none of this stands up to scrutiny. That is to say that every time the U.S. engages in a so-called humanitarian intervention, first of all, it generally is based on lies. Those who want to go to war fabricate stories about what's happening in various countries in order to invade.
In the morgue, Gaddafi soldiers killed in the fight for Ashdabia, and in the pockets of their uniforms, Viagra and condoms, weapons of war.
The U.S. then invariably leaves these countries in shambles, much worse off than they were before the intervention. And then the U.S., of course, does what it wanted to do all along, and that is take the resources out of the targeted country at will. And that's really what these wars are about.
So what kind of international legal framework do we have in place to stop a bully, especially if it's a bully with nuclear weapons and the only one to have actually used them against civilians in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and now with a military budget larger than that of the next 10 countries combined? Dan Kovalik?
The international legal structure we have to deal with that issue is embodied first and foremost in the United Nations Charter, which was agreed to by numerous countries after World War II. And the whole goal of the UN Charter was to prevent aggressive war. And so, for example, in Article 2.4, it clearly states that the use of force and even the threat of force are not permitted. Article 2.7 of the UN Charter says that no country has the right to intervene in the domestic affairs of another country. And there are only very limited exceptions to this. One is in Article 51, and that allows for the use of self-defense in the case of an armed attack against the country that wants to go to war. Now, very rarely is the U.S. attacked. And so Article 51, while the U.S. tries to invoke it often, really doesn't apply to most of these interventions. You know, we attacked Libya. Libya had never attacked us, right? And then you had, of course, the two Iraq invasions in 1990 and then in 2003. Again, Iraq never attacked us. Same thing with Afghanistan. You know, we claim we went there to get bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, but then we quickly moved to overthrow the Taliban, which again had not attacked us. So Article 51 is not a basis for these interventions. And the main basis for an intervention is found in the Security Council. The Security Council has a monopoly on the use of force. If a country wants to use military force, for example, to promote human rights, although again, that's a rare thing that that's really true, but let's assume that that's the goal, they need to go through the Security Council. Now, of course, it's tough to get authorization from the Security Council because you have the veto power in a few different countries, which happen to be countries that are at odds with each other, right? You have the U.S. on the one hand, and you have China and Russia on the other that have veto powers, and they often tend to cancel each other out. But that's how it should be. That was the goal. It was to make it very hard to use force because the lesson learned by World War II was that the greatest and most profound crime that the Nazis committed was their invasions of other countries. And these led to the other crimes that, of course, horrified the world, including the Holocaust. But the seed, the initial seed of those crimes was the unprovoked aggression against other countries and Europe. And the UN Charter was designed to prevent that. And so what the U.S. has done over time, and most international law experts agree, is they've effectively written the anti-intervention and anti-war provisions out of the UN Charter.
Can you talk about the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court and whether the United States has actually recognized the authority of those two?
The U.S. has been brought to the International Court of Justice on a number of occasions, most famously in the case of Nicaragua versus the United States, where the International Court of Justice found that the U.S. was violating customary international law through its support of the Contras in Nicaragua in the 1980s, through its mining of the Nicaraguan harbor, through other terrorist acts against Nicaragua. And what the U.S. did is to simply ignore the decision of the court. Not only to ignore the decision, but the U.S. never even showed up to defend itself. It simply said, we don't have to deal with the International Court of Justice, and so we won't. And so, again, the U.S. has undermined, you know, the main judicial body created to settle international disputes peacefully. The U.S.'s position is very clear, that the law applies to everyone but the United States. You know, and again, with the International Criminal Court, which didn't come till much later, it was negotiated by the Clinton administration, which tried its darndest to weaken the International Criminal Court and the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court as much as possible, and particularly again, those parts of the Rome Statute which prohibit aggressive war. Though it is very quick to argue and to call for the International Criminal Court to prosecute other world leaders, right? It's very happy to do that. But it's very, at the same time, the U.S. is very clear that the International Criminal Court has no jurisdiction over the United States. That's the U.S.'s position. And now that the International Criminal Court is trying to investigate the U.S. for war crimes in Afghanistan, based on the fact that Afghanistan is a party to the Rome Statute, meaning that it does have jurisdiction over war crimes in the country, the U.S. has said that it will not permit such an investigation. And in fact, Donald Trump sanctioned the International Criminal Court because of that investigation. And Joe Biden has continued to take the position that the International Criminal Court cannot investigate U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan.
What about sanctions? Are those codified in the UN Charter as a mechanism of pressure? And do unilateral coercive measures that the U.S. applies to its rivals, are those legal according to international law?
In terms of sanctions, the same ideas apply that apply to military interventions. That is, it's up to the Security Council to impose economic sanctions on countries to maintain international peace and security. It even says that in the Charter. An individual nation cannot impose sanctions, particularly extraterritorial sanctions, on another country. And what I mean by that is when a country like the U.S., which uses this tactic more than any other country, not only refuses to trade with another country, but actually penalizes third countries for trading with the target country. The U.S. has no right under international law to do that, again, without Security Council authorization, which, of course, the U.S. never seeks to get, for the most part, in order to impose sanctions.
The U.S., in conjunction with the EU, UK, and Canada, are announcing new sanctions against two current Chinese government officials for what the Treasury Department is calling serious human rights abuses.
The Biden administration is issuing new sanctions against nearly two dozen Russian government officials. President Biden has said he wants to take a more critical approach than the previous administration. A Kremlin spokesperson says that Russia, quote, will respond in kind.
Now, what has happened very recently in the last year or so, maybe 2 years, is that a number of countries, and there's about 17 of them, which include Russia and China and Iran, North Korea, Venezuela, Nicaragua, there's a number of others, they have banded together in this group of friends to defend the UN Charter, and particularly the parts of the UN Charter that prevent aggressive war.
Dan Kovalik, in late March, U.S.-China talks took place in Anchorage, Alaska, and it got pretty heated over there. Secretary of State Antony Blinken brought up accusations of China violating human rights in the Xinjiang province, and Blinken's Chinese counterpart, through an interpreter, responded. Let's take a listen.
China is firmly opposed to U.S. interference in China's internal affairs. We have expressed our staunch opposition to such interference, and we will take firm actions in response. On human rights, we hope that the United States will do better on human rights. For our two countries, it's important that we manage our respective affairs well instead of deflecting the blame on somebody else in this world.
Yeah, well, I mean, China obviously makes a good point. And by the way, I think China walked out on that meeting pretty quickly because they're tired of being lectured to on human rights, right, by a country, the United States, which, again, is so deficient in terms of human rights on many levels, but which has decided it's going to go around the world and police the world, allegedly on the ground of improving human rights, when invariably these interventions undermine human rights in these countries.
And finally, former President Trump seemed to have a difficult time defending the U.S. empire properly. He would say things like this.
I'm interested in Libya if we take the oil. If we don't take the oil, no interest.
When it came to foreign policy, Trump seemed to be almost too honest in his statements.
After all of those lives and after all of the money we spent, and if that's going to happen, we take the oil.
He let the mask fall off the empire's face, so to speak. Do you think that the current administration can actually put that mask back on the face of empire? Or has the average U.S. consumer of media caught on to it and won't be fooled anymore?
No, I think they already have put the mask back on. Again, you know, sadly, you know, you have kids that are still in cages. In fact, there's three times more kids in cages right now than when Trump left office, right? Biden is still deporting huge numbers of people. Biden is staying in Afghanistan, where Trump actually wanted to get out of Afghanistan. But for most liberals who voted for Biden, it's just fine because they don't care that when he does those things. They only cared when Trump did it. And they didn't care when Obama did it. Obama deported 3 million people. And he deported more people in his last term than Trump did during his entire term in office. So this lack of principle is quite disappointing.
Dan Kovalik, thank you very much. Dan Kovalik teaches law at the University of Pittsburgh. He's the author of several books, his most recent being No More War. For Pacifica, I'm Paulina Vasiliev.
Over Baghdad, dancers of death, murder in the air with the next breath. Macho queens selling war makers' toys, raining destruction, good old boys. Deathbringer in Queen George's eyes, read his lips, war maker lies. Religious Reich's revenging sword.
This is Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. The cases of Bosnia and Rwanda are the most often cited in arguments for humanitarian war. Bosnia as a case in which the U.S. and NATO intervened, Rwanda as a case in which they did not. But the truth of both histories is disputed. This is a conversation with Judy Reaver, author of In Praise of Blood, Crimes of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, a book which upended the received history of the Rwandan War and Genocide of 1990-1994.
Judy, the story that most people know, the one that's in the Wikipedia and more or less told in Hotel Rwanda, is that in April 1994, suddenly Hutus developed a case of mass psychosis and bloodlust and killed 500,000 to 1 million Rwandans. And they were egged on by the radio. And then they were saved by General Paul Kagame, who appeared in the movie out of nowhere. And before going on, I think I should say that our friend Paul Rusesabagina, the real life hero of Hotel Rwanda, is in prison. And he actually has a much more complex view of what happened than was portrayed in the movie. So tell us what really happened.
Well, that story that you described, more or less, was forged in a climate of terror, violence, and propaganda. It was put together fairly quickly as the dust was settling in July 1994 and in the months and years after the Rwandan Patriotic Front, the RPF, led by Paul Kagame, seized power. My book tells the story of what happened from 1990 when the RPF invaded from their base in Uganda, waged a 3.5-year scorched earth campaign against northern Rwanda, uprooting about 1 million Hutus in the north and sending them into displacement camps in terrible conditions, and killed many, many Hutus in the north. And that set the stage for the conflict to come. And so my book is really a reexamination of the genocide. And by the genocide, we often refer to the genocide against Tutsis. There are various estimates as to how many ethnic Tutsis were killed in Hutu-controlled zones in Rwanda from April to July. And some of those estimates range from 400,000 to 1 million people. And the West, when it's being generous, adds that something called moderate Hutus, the international community calls moderate Hutus, Hutus who supposedly resisted the violence that other Hutus waged, or Hutu opposition members Hutus who were supposedly opponents of the Habyarimana regime. So there's a way in which Hutus are described in that official genocide story. So my book tells a different story. And what my book actually says is that Kagame's RPF unleashed the genocide by creating conditions of violence before April 94. The RPF and Kagame were responsible for shooting down the plane that carried the Hutu president at the time, Juvenal Habyarimana, and his Burundian counterpart, and the assassination of those two presidents unleashed a wave of ethnic massacres. So the RPF is responsible for the terrible massacres that ensued as soon as the plane was shot down. And then the RPF, according to the research I've done for many, many years, then started to kill in a systematic, organized way Hutus from the north down the east of the country and in every zone that its troops seized, and therefore committed its own genocide against Hutus. All the while that Tutsis were being targeted for mass extermination in Hutu-controlled zones. The other thing I say in my book, and this is backed up by very sound evidence, some of which came from ICTR confidential documents. The ICTR was the tribunal set up to investigate crimes during 1994 in Rwanda. I say that Tutsi commandos, or rather RPF commandos, infiltrated Hutu militia and killed Tutsi civilians during the genocide. So the RPF fueled the genocide against Tutsis.
Since this show's theme is quote-unquote humanitarian intervention, could you tell us about the two UN interventions, which would have been legal according to international law, were stopped?
Well, there were two very important international operations. One that was already on the ground was UN peacekeeping operation in Rwanda before the plane was shot down carrying the Hutu president. And that peacekeeping operation, which was estimated to have about 5,000 UN peacekeepers, could have actually stepped into gear and saved a lot of Rwandans and actually created zones of security for Rwandans once the massacres were unleashed. But the United States did its best to dismantle that UN peacekeeping mission and persuaded the UN to vote to bring those peacekeepers home while that violence was raging. So in other words, there was ample opportunity to stop the killings, but the U.S. used its influence and pressured the U.N. to let Kagame's military campaign proceed. So the second U.N.-led military intervention that was discussed was 2 years later, when Canada, rather naively at the time, decided that it would lead a multinational force to protect Rwandan Hutu refugees. And what that was really an attempt to provide a humanitarian corridor in Zaire, where Hutus had fled to after the genocide. And there had, you know, more than a million Hutus had lived inside Zaire's border in a number of camps. Kagame, of course, 2 years after the genocide, decided he was going to bust up those camps, attack Zaire, and force those Hutus home. That was the cover story. But what happened on the ground is the RPF started attacking those camps and killing a lot of Hutu refugees in October 1996. The multinational force that Canada had proposed never got off the ground. Why? Because the United Nations political insiders, the bigwigs, and also in particular Washington, dismantled that force before it got underway. It did not want a UN-led force to protect refugees because it was seen as a possible impediment to Kagame's military sweep across the Congo. So anything, for example, that would have documented what Kagame's forces had done immediately after they had invaded and what it was doing from the Kivus and then across the entire country, anything that would have documented and also stopped that military campaign was seen as a very bad idea for Washington. So there are several million people who have died, some directly from violence and others from war-related diseases. And that war rages off and on today.
Judy Reaver, author of In Praise of Blood, Crimes of the Rwandan Patriotic Front. In 2019, Rwandan political prisoner Victoire Ingabire Umuhoza addressed the Women's International Network for Democracy and Peace on the struggle for truth about the Rwandan genocide and the folly of using that tragedy as an excuse for going to war to, quote, stop the next Rwanda, unquote.
Mesdames, mesdemoiselles et messieurs, bonsoir. Je remercie le Réseau international des femmes pour la démocratie et la paix qui m'a invité à assister à cet événement.
Good evening, everybody. My thanks to the International Women's Network for Democracy and Peace, who invited me to participate in this evening. I thank them again for their brilliant idea of creating this award to be granted to anyone who peacefully militates for peace and democracy in the countries of the African Great Lakes region. I thank all members of the jury for the prize, for their availability, and their impeccable work. Specifically, I ask you to help me applaud Mrs. Roger Biloa, Mr. Juan Guerrero, and Mrs. Therese Bologi. Since I have been involved in the political struggle for the democratization of my country and the stability of the countries in the African Great Lakes region, I have witnessed Mrs. Roger Biloa fighting like a lioness to ensure that the world gets the real picture of violent conflict in the African Great Lakes region.
Qui ont endeuillé les pays de la région des Grands Lacs. Monsieur Carrero, c'est hier que je lisais la lettre que vous avez adressée à la fille de Paul Rusesawagina. Dans la dite lettre,
I was quite pleased to read the letter that Juan Guerrero wrote to Paul Rusesabagina's daughter, where he denounced some human rights organizations which wear double hats. On one side, they denounce human rights violations, and on the other, campaign for war in Syria or Libya, or even distort the truth of the crimes committed in the countries of the Great Lakes region. I thank all laureates who are fighting for the reign of justice and democracy in the Great Lakes region of Africa. Recently, I published a document titled, How Rwanda Can Maximize Its Potential in the Region. In my humble opinion, I described three steps that must be taken to stabilize and develop countries of this region. First, the countries of the Great Lakes region must be democratized. Democracy is about more than holding elections. In a democracy, minority voices are heard and they are respected. Opposition candidates present their political programs to the electorate without threat or intimidation, and the freedom of expression and the freedom of press are protected.
Les citoyens des pays de la région des Grands Lacs d'Afrique n'aspirent qu'à une gouvernance.
The people of the countries of the Great Lakes region of Africa need to participate actively in the decisions and definition of policies that affect them. Secondly, we must approach an end to the impunity which has been exercised in the countries of the Great Lakes for decades. In this regard, I congratulate the Congolese people who are campaigning today for an international tribunal to prosecute crimes in DRC. And finally, the last step, there needs to be a transparent approach to economic interests in the region. For example, the people of the DRC must be the first beneficiaries of their resources by doing clean business with the other people in the region and the rest of the world in a win-win position. However, security conditions must be met beforehand to ensure a safe environment for any business activity. Today, we live in a world where might is right. The right of the strong prevails. But, as Rousseau has clearly explained, force does not make law. We all know that strength needs the law to hide its weakness, and that strength is never strong enough to always be the master.
N'est jamais assez fort pour être toujours maître. Aujourd'hui, c'est la grande guerre entre le bien et le mal.
Today, more than ever before, there is a great conflict between good and evil, between trust and lies. However, I hope you share with me the conviction that good will eventually win against evil and that the countries of the Great Lakes region of Africa will rise and shine again one day as they deserve. Thank you.
La bien souligné dans sa lettre. Je vous remercie.
Victoire Ingabire,
The UN Security Council has maintained a UN peacekeeping mission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo since 1999, but it has never succeeded in keeping the peace in the country's vastly resource-rich and war-ravaged east, bordering Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, and Tanzania. The current conflict began when Uganda and Rwanda invaded DRC in 1996, then again in 1998, and some say that the ineffective peacekeeping mission's real purpose is managing the war in the interests of all the big powers with resource interests in DRC. For the past several years, Western media have added a new twist, reporting implausible claims that ISIS is present in DRC, even though the population is only 1% Muslim. Here's Maurice Carney, Executive Director of Friends of the Congo, speaking to Netfa Freeman of Pacifica's WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C.
I want to talk about, obviously, militarization, militarism on the continent, particularly Western militarism, the U.S., France, all that, is a constant issue.
Yes.
And in the Congo in particular, we're seeing the collaborations between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo government around what's termed Islamic extremism. And then recently, they're reporting there was another massacre in eastern Congo attack.
A few things, Anesha. When you see these conflicts, instability on the African continent, I think our Kenyan sister Wangari Maathai put it best. She says, when you see insecurity and conflict, it's almost always around battle for resources. And as you know, Congo is enormously wealthy, arguably the wealthiest country in the world as it relates to natural resources. And the eastern part of the Congo has been unstable, primarily due to invasions by two U.S. allies, repeated invasions and support of militia groups in the east of the country by Rwanda, led by Paul Kagame, and by Uganda, led by Yoweri Museveni, both of whom benefit from U.S. military largesse. We're talking about equipment. We're talking about money. We're talking about training. We're talking about intelligence. They, as a result of that incredible support from the United States, they've been able to destabilize the east of the Congo while extracting tremendous wealth in terms of timber, gold, coltan, tin, you name it. And they wouldn't be able to do this without the backing of the United States, not only in those areas that I just mentioned, but the crimes that they've committed in that part of Africa, in the Great Lakes region of Africa, the U.S. has played a role in cleansing those crimes on an international level by running political and diplomatic interference whenever international bodies try to hold Paul Kagame or Yoweri Museveni accountable for the crimes that they've committed in the Congo. So that is the framework in which we see a lot of the conflict and instability taking place in the east of the country. Now, when you talk about Islamic forces, we have to be really careful, because what has happened is that there's been an attempt to put a label on some of that instability and label some of the militia groups as Islamic groups that are supported by Al-Qaeda. Now, what this does is that it triggers the United States. It gives them the go-ahead to bring in U.S. military and the local proxy leaders in the region. They want the U.S. military to come in because they feel like they're going to benefit more. They're going to get more money. They're going to get more equipment. They're going to get more support. And what they do is they take that money, that equipment and all, and then they suppress progressive forces in their countries that are trying to bring about change and remove some of these neocolonial leaders that we see on the African continent. So the notion that there is an Islamic terror threat in the east of the country is fleeting at best. It's a PR stunt to try and label any kind of instability that takes place as a terrorist threat in order to provide access for AFRICOM and U.S. military presence or French military presence. So we have just be really cautious around that.
Labeling. But let me ask you this one last question in the time, the minute that we have. And if you were talking to someone, just a layperson who looks at the news in the continent and just sees reports of people attacking innocent civilians and just killing them, it just seems like Africans are just crazy and terrorists are crazy. And so how do we explain that to people? What's going on?
Well, I think that this whole principle, the principle, the notion, Netfa, of neocolonialism is really important, because at the core of neocolonialism, right, is that you see an African continent that is being led by Africans. So the outside, people looking from the outside say, hey, these Africans are leading Africans, so why are they killing each other? Why are black folks killing black folks? Well, the fact of the matter is that these leaders that are on the continent are agents of neocolonialism. That means that they are leaders that have been put in place primarily by Western powers after independence heroes have been removed through assassinations and coups and overthrows. What you see is a situation where you have neocolonial leaders that are put in place to suppress the population. And in resisting, the population resisting, then you get a lot of instability. You get a lot of conflict. So there's this ongoing battle on the African continent for freedom and liberation on part of people who want to see a free, liberated Pan-African continent. So that's probably one of the ways in any case that I can explain what people see. And just quickly, what also happens is that the media takes those particular cases, isolated cases of crimes or instability, and they blow it up to make it a whole. You know, that is to say, they focus on a particular part. The Congo, for example, is the size of Western Europe. It's got almost 90 million people. And there's a lot that's taken place. There are progressive movements, Pan-African movements, a lot of resistance that's going on. And the conflict and the violence is not the only thing that's unfolding on the in the Congo. So there's also that where the media blows up, small, remote instability and make it appear as if it's happening throughout the whole country, which is not the case.
That was Maurice Carney, Executive Director of Friends of the Congo, speaking to Netva Freeman, producer and host of Voices with Vision on WPFW Washington, D.C.
Mama Botanga Malamu Oyoye Baby Sanga Tala Lelo Yo Nakoma Moto Na Velo Nakoma Kotambola Nanzite Nakoma Moto Na Bakane Babeki Ye 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 Ye.
Since last October, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front in the Ethiopian state of Tigray has been at war with Ethiopia's federal government in Addis Ababa, and U.S. officials have placed all the blame on the government of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. Here is U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, on March 4th.
The United States is alarmed by the humanitarian and human rights situation in Ethiopia. What's happening in Ethiopia has had and will continue to have devastating consequences for thousands of innocent people, and it poses a direct threat to regional peace and security. We need to address it immediately. The onus to prevent further atrocities and human suffering falls squarely on the Ethiopian government's shoulders. We urge the Ethiopian government to support an immediate end to the fighting in Tigray. And to that end, the prompt withdrawal of Eritrean forces and Amhara regional forces from Tigray are essential steps. And we urge the broader region to work fast and together toward a peaceful solution. For our part, the United States is committed to working bilaterally and multilaterally to help secure an end to the violence. We are committed to holding perpetrators of abuses and violations on all sides to account. And we are committed to addressing and assisting with the humanitarian and the human rights crisis. To that end, this week, we have deployed a disaster assistance response team to Ethiopia to lead the scale-up of U.S. government humanitarian assistance. Our goal is to help people affected by the conflict in the Tigray region. And our hope is that others will join us in this urgent, necessary, life-saving effort.
On the same day that Greenfield made these remarks, the UN Security Council met to consider a statement that would have called on the Ethiopian People's Defense Force to withdraw from Tigray and voted it down, with Russia, China, and India, and all the African members of the current council voting no, while the U.S. and other Western powers voted yes. Those who voted no agreed that the conflict is an Ethiopian conflict and the international community should respect Ethiopia's national sovereignty by staying out of it. The African Union also voted against interference. Here are three different viewpoints on the Ethiopian conflict expressed by members of the Ethiopian diaspora in the U.S. Two were reported on Pacifica's KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, and one was produced at Pacifica affiliate KGNU 88.5 FM in Boulder, Colorado. First, a November protest by Tigrayans upset by the actions of the Ethiopian federal government in Tigray outside CNN Los Angeles last November.
What should action look like? Are you looking for a humanitarian intervention? We know that those interventions on behalf of the United States government may have actually worsened the situation in several countries like Libya. Are you looking for humanitarian intervention?
Well, we're not looking for U.S. involvement in the war, as you said. It's never helped before. We want the U.S. to put sanctions on Ethiopian government. We want the U.N. to put sanctions on Ethiopian government. We want the U.S. and the U.N. to pressure the Ethiopian government from using drones and all these bombs they're using to attack our people. So if they put sanctions, put pressure on the Ethiopian government, and make it official that they stand with the people of Tigray.
What's the importance of Israel there?
Well, Israel would be good if they stand with Tigray and help us, because Israel has been involved in Ethiopia in a lot of ways. And we actually have the Jewish.com is from North Ethiopia, some in Tigray, some in Gondar. So, yeah, Israelis being involved will really be helpful, because I think they are very influential in the world and they can pass our message to the world for us.
Is there anything else that you want
to
add?
Yeah, I wanted to focus on why it's so important for us to have an immediate international intervention, because the only way this could be stopped is if the UN acts. And for the UN to act, the US needs to stop. They need to stop blocking the initiative. They kept on saying African problems should be solved by African leaders. But yet we have seen the African Union shamelessly supporting the war. So the African Union is not fit to resolve this matter. And so the US needs to stop this nonsense and push for the case to be brought to the UN National, to the UN Security Council.
Next, a rally in support of the Ethiopian and Eritrean governments outside San Francisco City Hall on March 26.
Fellow Eritrean participants, fellow Ethiopian participants, and dear friends of Eritrea and Ethiopia, we Eritreans and Ethiopians are raising our voices together in defense of our countries and in affirmation of our peace and friendship, which is an integral part of a cooperative Horn of Africa with Sudan, South Sudan, Somalia, and Djibouti. We are gathered today to express our deep dismay at the injustice that's being perpetrated by the Biden administration on the Eritrean and Ethiopian peoples, at the lies and fabrications they are spreading, at the ill-considered measures they are pursuing. The TPLF plunged Tigray into war with the aim of overthrowing the government of Ethiopia as well as the Eritrean government. Ethiopia has the right and duty to defend its territory and restore legal order. Yet the U.S. refuses to unequivocally acknowledge the TPLF's culpability and deliberately sweeps its crimes under the rug. Inexplicably, the United States government blames Ethiopia, scapegoats Eritrea, and seeks to pressure and intimidate both countries. And Ethiopia is supposed to be America's strongest regional ally. We deplore this harmful travesty. Our message to the United States administration is short and simple. Please, hands off.
I'm so happy that our Eritrean brothers and Ethiopians are together here. I grew up with a lot of Eritreans, and I am so happy about this. And I want to congratulate you, and I believe next year we'll all be here celebrating our victory. Yeah. If you can hear me, say, we will win.
We will win.
We will prevail.
We will prevail.
Lastly, Ethiopian scholar Dr. Damisi Alemahu, a statistics professor at Columbia University, speaking to Rob Prince, a retired professor of international relations at the University of Denver's Corbell School of International Studies, and a producer host at Pacifica affiliate KGNU 88.5 FM in Boulder, Colorado.
Outside work, my concern is mostly about the political and human rights situation in my native country. Of course, this is true about most Ethiopians in the diaspora, especially in the United States. As you may know, there is a vibrant Ethiopian community in this country. Now, no one knows the exact number, but estimates range from several hundred thousand to over a million. The Washington, D.C. area and the San Francisco Bay area, there are quite a lot, including in other places such as Atlanta, Dallas, and so on. Ethiopia is a large country with a growing population of over 100 million people and over 80 different languages. And it is a country where the three great religions, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, have coexisted in harmony for centuries. Notably, Ethiopia is the only African country and perhaps one of the handful of countries in the world that preserved its independence for thousands of years. Of course, Ethiopians are known for defeating colonialist Italy at the Battle of Adowa in 1896, thereby serving as trailblazers for all freedom fighters in the rest of Africa and across the world. So, unsurprisingly, the Ethiopian community in the U.S. reflects this diversity and pride in history.
Well, that's very interesting. Here in Denver, we have a sizable community also of Ethiopians. Been told the number is anywhere from 30 to 35,000, and a very active community, I might add.
That's correct.
So, Dr. Alamehu, there have been voices in Congress and in the media of late here in the United States calling for humanitarian intervention of some sort, of sanctions against the Ethiopian government for its military intervention in the Tigray province. The media narrative, to my knowledge, is skewed. Am I missing something?
No, you are not missing anything. You are on target, and thank you for this timely questions. In fact, the call for sanctions against Addis Ababa is a threat not only to Ethiopia, but also to the peace and security in general in the Horn of Africa. When Ethiopians voted in tens of thousands for the Democratic Party and the Biden administration in the last elections, they were hoping that there would be a more rational U.S. policy toward Ethiopia. This is because most Ethiopians here in the U.S. and elsewhere had been frustrated by the racist policy followed by the previous administration, especially when it unfairly sided with Egypt and even encouraged Egypt to blow up, to quote Trump's language, a dam known as the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam that is being built to lift the poor people of Ethiopia from poverty. To the dismay of most American Ethiopians, the Biden administration is now following a misguided policy. This is in part because certain members of the Biden administration appear to have a special affinity to a terrorist group known as the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, that ruled Ethiopia with an iron fist for nearly three decades, supported then, of course, by the same individuals and groups now in the Biden administration. During its 27 years of atrocious rule, the TPLF not only committed horrendous human rights violations, but also embezzled billions of dollars in aid money. Just to give you one example, as reported by David Steinman in a 2017 issue of Forbes magazine, the amount of money stolen by the TPLF leaders while in power was $30 billion, equivalent to the amount of all the financial aid the country received from the U.S.
I've read that article and I found it very interesting and wonder where that money wound up and how it is being used. Do you have any insight?
I don't need to tell you what kind of influence one can exert if one has that much money in Western banks. Unfortunately, that is why we are now witnessing fake news promoted by major media outlets and humanitarian organizations. The fake news is then cited in policy statements, such as one by the US State Department, and also in congressional hearings. Let me be clear here. No Ethiopian would want to see any human rights violations in the region of Tigray, where the focus of the media campaign and political posturing has been. Tigray is the birthplace of Ethiopian civilization. Nobody cares more about the people of Tigray than the rest of the Ethiopian people. If the news media Congress or the Biden administration are truly concerned about human rights in Ethiopia, then they should focus instead on the violence that is raging in the rest of the country, especially in the regions known as Oromia and Benishangul Gumuz. Thanks to an apartheid constitution that the TPLF leaders, in their attempt to divide and rule, had imposed on the people of Ethiopia, the Amhara ethnic group and other followers of the Orthodox Christian Church are being slaughtered in thousands and displaced in millions.
And there's been very little reporting of that.
Absolutely. That is just disconcerting.
I've read those accounts, and I just find it more than curious that the attacks that are taking place within Ethiopia in the non-Tigray provinces are virtually not reported at all, whereas the allegations of what's happening in Tigray.
What is sad about this whole thing?
Looking at U.S.-Ethiopian relations, you know, for so many years, both countries have claimed these relations are warm, are solid, and there appears to be a change in U.S. policy towards Ethiopia, and policy that is becoming increasingly hostile and adversarial. What factors have led to this changing relationship?
Actually, there is no change in policy, but a continuation of the same old bad policy. The U.S. policy, at least toward Ethiopia, has always been a misguided one. It is a myopic policy pivoted on short-term expediency rather than a long-term strategy that is grounded in the protection of human rights and the building of democratic institutions that will guarantee the preservation of U.S. interests reliably. You may recall in the 70s, they pushed Ethiopia into the grip of the Soviet Union, and the country suffered under successive dictatorship. Presently, the U.S. policymakers are busy trying to advance the disinformation campaign of the TPLF instead of formulating pragmatic policy that serves the long-term interests of the American taxpayers. Ethiopia can be a strong and strategic ally of the U.S. with a population of over 100 million, its location and history have now attracted the attentions of many global players, including China, Russia, and the Arab League nations. In addition to the ethnic violence mentioned earlier, the country is under assault from multiple directions. Islamic fundamentalism is a genuine threat, with Al-Shabaab from the south. From the west, Sudan had signed an alliance pact with Egypt on occupied and disputed territory. And instead of formulating a cogent policy for this complex geopolitical situation, what State Department officials appear to be busy about is trying to appease their friends in the TPLF circle, who are putting to maximal use the money they had embezzled for the purpose of engaging highly paid PR and lobbying firms and influencing policy. I hope reporters like you would enlighten the American taxpayers and help bring sanity to the State Department, Congress, and the media.
Dr. Alamehu, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Boom goes London, boom Perry, more room for you and more. City, the whole world round will just be another American town. Oh, how peaceful it will be. We'll set everybody free. You wear a Japanese kimono, baby, be Italian shoes to me. They all hate us anyhow. So let's drop the big one now. Let's drop the big one now.
And governments that respect human rights are more likely to support the rules-based international order that the United States and our allies have built and invested in for decades and decades. Look at the countries that run roughshod over the rights of their people. They are almost always the same countries that flout internationally accepted rules beyond their borders, whether that's by lopping off the territory of other countries, launching cyber attacks, harassing dissidents, spreading disinformation, or breaking trade rules.
That concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by me, Ann Garrison, and Polina Vasiliev. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Seltzer. Artistic contributions were made by Tom Lehrer, staff Benda Bilili, John Trudell, Randy Newman, and Kizito Mihiro. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. I'm Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.